Cats and Kittens. Dig the hottest and the coolest music around on Swing Time every Monday afternoon, 2 p.m. till 4. The big bands, the small groups, and new swing music. Hear it all on Swing Time, Monday 2 till 4, the only swing on this radio thing.
Jam jump is solid jive.
Makes you 9 foot tall when you're 4 foot five.
Hi, this is Bill Keith from Light from the Underground, heard every other Saturday from 10 a.m. till noon. Wishing you and your family a wonderful holiday and a very Merry Christmas.
This is Steve Homer, host of Culture City Radio, wishing you a very happy holiday to all the great music fans in Detroit and all over the world. Thank you, and happy holidays and a happy new year.
Kitty Love here to wish you and yours a very merry holiday season and a happy new year.
1 minute I'm fine, then out of nowhere I'll get this terrible pain in my hands. Another day my face is swollen. It's so frustrating. I'm 27, but I feel like I'm 72. I was gonna get married next summer. Now my wedding's on hold. My life is on hold. I've never felt so scared and alone. I want answers.
I want answers. I'm a junior in college. At least I was. I'm home now because I'm so sick. Now my hair's falling out. You know how embarrassing that is? It feels like I'm going crazy. My friends don't call me anymore. I don't care. I don't care about anything.
I don't care about anything. I don't even try to hide the rash on my face with makeup anymore. Today I was so tired, my mom had to help me get dressed. I'm depressed. I'm terrified. I need to know what's happening to me.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Paul Von Ward. Mr. Von Ward takes the sentiment, "We are not alone," one step further. The title of his book is, "We Never Have Been Alone." We've never been alone, excuse me. We've never been alone. A history of extraterrestrial intervention. In it, he explores the ancient astronaut theory, world religions, and cultural myths to demonstrate the correlation between the aforementioned and today's UFO phenomenon. Paul Von Ward is an independent scholar, author, and ordained Baptist minister. For three decades, he served as a U.S. naval officer, U.S. diplomat, and international educator with graduate degrees in government and psychology from Harvard and Florida State University. He is a MUFON consultant MUFON consultant in psychology. So let's welcome to the show Mr. Paul Von Ward. Hello.
Thanks very much, Dave. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, it's our pleasure. And tell me, how did you first get involved with the UFO phenomenon?
I think, you know, the first thing that I remember about that was many, many years ago. My father, we were farmers living out in the woods in northwest Florida, and my father was sort of a hunter and spent a lot of time in the woods. And one night, my mother and I and my siblings were sitting at home. Probably, I think some of us were sitting on the porch outdoors, and my father went away down the road and into the dark woods, and all of a sudden we heard a big blast of his shotgun, and we thought, boy, we're going to have some game to eat. You know, he must have been a successful hunter tonight. Well, we waited until he got back, and he didn't have any game on his arm, and his face was a little white. And we were asking what happened, and he said he had seen a huge sort of barrel with lights all around it down in the woods, and he shot at it, and it flew up in the air. So, of course, that was many years ago, and I was so young that I had no context in which to put such a story.
Right.
And, in fact, we sort of, you know, forgot about it after a while until I began to read Eric von Daniken's books, The Chariots of the Gods, and so on, like so many people have, and began to put some pieces together, because about the same time I started reading those books, I had been puzzled by some of my college classes and my reading, because I was very much interested in ancient history and the whole question of myths and legends from all countries around the world. And I had, in reading them, you know, in sociology and history and other courses and in my own reading, all these cultures talked about the gods coming from the skies.
Right.
And they were all over. And you mentioned the Baptist part of my past career. I'm no longer active in that role, but at that time I was very much active in the church and studying the Bible and talking to people about it. And the Bible itself had stories much like the myths and legends in all the cultures that I was reading in college, and talking about the gods coming down from the skies and walking with men and sleeping with the daughters of men, and all of these sort of stories that were seen from a theological point of view as some metaphor or some way of expressing the divine part of the universe and so on. But I saw that they began to make sense in terms of the chariots of the gods and the ancient astronaut theory. So anyhow, that you know, I was doing all these other things that are part of my career, Navy service, Foreign Service, U.S. diplomatic post abroad, and work in Washington in the State Department, and running an international nonprofit, and all of that. You had to, I had to earn a living to get the kids through college, and you know, all of that function.
And ufology doesn't pay well, does it?
It doesn't pay well. Exactly right.
Move, move on.
What I was trying to convey in response to your question, you know, these things sort of build up over time, and as over the years, I've, I guess I got first active in the local MUFON group in Washington, D.C. when I was there. I left, I first arrived there in 1965 and finally moved out in 1995. So sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, I began to have professional contact with other investigators and so on. But when I began to look at the current phenomena, you know, the different stories of abductees or people who had contacts of various kinds or who reported getting knowledge and information from them. I mean, just like the Hills experience, you know, they were given...
Betty and Barney Hill?
Betty and Barney Hill, right. You know, the one that famous case of many years ago.
Right.
You know, their reports were that we were given information and advanced knowledge and so forth. Well, you know, that's what the ancient astronaut theory is about.
Right.
And so I began to pull these things together, and I never pulled the whole picture together until in the early 90s when a friend of mine at the U.S. Library of Congress Research Division gave me a copy of Zachariah Sitchin's book, The Twelfth Planet, and Genesis Revisited. And that began to stimulate my mind because I'm sort of a synthetic thinker. I pull a lot of pieces together and so on. And I began to realize that we have a story of our history that goes back to the very beginning of human consciousness, and I marked that to be about 250,000 years ago, something like that, where we have not the first glimmers of consciousness in the Homo erectus, the hominoids, hominids of, you know, 5 million years ago up to a quarter of a million years ago, because there was consciousness in those earlier predecessors of ours.
Right.
But, you know, we had this gap in the fields of the fossil record, the talk about genetic beginnings that we have developed over the last 10 or 15 years.
You're talking about the missing link?
The missing link.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at that time, when I started reading Zachariah Sitchin's work, I started to pull on my own studies that I had been doing in looking at, as I said, the fossil record. I was keeping up with the genetic research that was being done and trying to figure out, you know, when different things happened in human development. In linguistics, I was very fascinated by what linguists did in their own speculation about the earliest human languages, and that was, you know, they came up with the notion that we had a proto-world language about 100,000 years ago, and lo and behold, that corresponded with, you know, the likely arising of not Homo sapiens, because that's about 250,000 years ago, but about 100,000 years ago, the arising of Homo sapiens sapiens. And so that's our modern, you know...
modern-day man.
Modern-day man. Yeah. And so I began to look at other things, looking at the languages in Africa and sorting out the relationships and which were the oldest ones and where were the changes made over time. Looking at myths and legends of, you know, like Atlantis that Plato wrote about, you know, all these 2,000 plus years ago. Looking at some of the other material, esoteric material. And that evolved over a decade or so. And I wrote the first book, the early 8 or 9 years ago. And then brought that forward to the present, where we're talking about the whole story from the first intervention. I can't really say the first intervention of advanced beings in this 250,000 year ago period,
right,
because there could have been extraterrestrial intervention on planet Earth, you know, much, much earlier than that.
Even
some mainstream scientists, you know, have a notion of panspermia, that life might have started, or human predecessors might have been a function of seeding of the planet Earth.
Right, but mainstream science just says that, you know, this is stardust, for example, that drifts like seeds, like dandelion seeds do in the wind,
right.
But it goes through the cosmic winds and lands on Earth and seeds life here on Earth. But they don't seem to buy the notion that actual beings in spaceships came to Earth and found a simian race, and through genetic engineering created Homo sapien. Now, I don't know, is that your theory as well, or?
No. My theory, of course, what I was suggesting earlier is that there could have been other ways of life starting on the planet Earth.
I mean, such as?
We have biologists today trying to figure out, biologists and chemists and other people in the life sciences who multidimensional efforts to try to create, the first life organism from inert chemical combinations of one kind or the other. And we haven't been able to succeed with that at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm suggesting that maybe that first life sperm may have come either through, the dandelion metaphor that you used,
mm-hmm.
or by the hand of more advanced beings.
Right.
But what I'm concerned about in the book, We've Never Been Alone, is that genetic intervention and what I call the colonial structure that the Elohim, the Anunnaki, there are different terms, as you know, used mm-hmm. for these early intervention species, whatever it is. I mean, we just use the Bible or the Sumerian texts to give them a name, but it appears, at least from my point of view, that the mixing of the DNA that is apparently the cause of the arising of Homo sapiens from the Homo erectus type predecessors of ours, and the Homo sapiens, that we have a compatible DNA with these advanced beings who colonized us and actually treated humans like humans today, and over the last 500 years or the last thousands of years have done on lesser societies in our own cultures. Europe colonized the Western Hemisphere and parts of Africa and Asia starting in the 15th, 16th century to spread around the world. And
right.
I'm using that as a metaphor.
But how do we know that there's a direct intervention there if we don't have some of their DNA as well?
Well, the point is, so this is a real dilemma. Because I have a good friend, Lloyd Pye, who is very much engaged in the same intervention hypothesis that I'm working with. But he's looking at the genetic side of things.
Yeah, he's been on the show before.
Of detail, and he's looking for, the alien gene. But
right.
what may be the case, the reason we don't easily find the alien genes is that they're in us. That's a part of our DNA. And what percentage is what we had in the Homo erectus earlier primate DNA pools on this planet and what is alien is very difficult to sort out.
Mm.
And I'm of the opinion, and this is your speculation at this point, but I think that, our genes that we have in the human genome is, between 20 and 30,000 genes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only 2 or 5% of our whole DNA repository in our system, and that 95% is, we call it junk DNA.
Mm-hmm.
We are now understanding that is a very important actor or a source of the expression of our genes. In other words, 10 or 15 years ago, we thought, you find this gene and you can trace it to a specific characteristic or health problem or whatever in an individual human.
Mm-hmm.
We now know that doesn't work. There are all kinds of other energetic, informational influences on the expression of our genes. So I think that we have, scientists, of course, won't even consider this at this point, mm-hmm. but there's no reason to reject the notion that a lot of that could be extraterrestrial.
Right.
And that's what makes the difference between us and the other species on the planet.
And not just seeds floating through the cosmic winds, right?
No, no.
But direct intervention, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. See, I think there are two stages in the intervention. One, I think the first one was the genetic manipulation of our predecessor species. Mm-hmm. In other words, to make that shift from erectus to Homo sapien. That I think is probably a genetic experiment. And Zachariah Sitchin does a good job of trying to speculate, you know, how that might have happened. And I think his views on that are about as good as anybody can develop at this point.
Well, Sitchin's theory was that exactly what I had said, that E.T. had intervened by taking a simian race of beings that they found on Earth, and through genetic engineering, mix their DNA with their own DNA, extraterrestrial DNA, with the Earthbound creature to make human beings.
I think that's what I'm describing as the first step.
Oh, okay.
And then the second step, though, is actual interspecies reproduction. And I go back to not only the Sumerian text, but other texts from around the world when you have accounts of the gods having intercourse with humans. And we certainly, a part of that story is in our Torah or the Old Testament for Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the second stage. And so I think that at that point we had even more of mixing of DNA at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we get from Homo erectus to the Homo sapiens is the genetic intervention. You might call it the laboratory experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the second stage into Homo sapiens sapiens, and that's what I call the interspecies miscegenation colonial experience.
Right.
And you think about it happening as Europeans moved into the Americas and Africa and other places. They then mixed their own genes with the local people who were colonized, and we have mixed races, and in other words, we've seen that over the last several hundred years, the mixing of racial and genetic groups
right.
around the planet.
Right.
So I think we're now doing among ourselves what the ABs, as I call them, the advanced beings, they were more advanced than we were because mm-hmm. they had the technologies and the experience and so
right.
on to manipulate us.
Right.
But we're experiencing at a present level something of what I think happened about 100,000 years ago.
Right. Paul, I have to take about 30 seconds just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves here out of Henry Ford Community College in beautiful Dearborn, Michigan. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Mr. Paul Von Ward, the author of We've Never Been Alone, A History of Extraterrestrial Intervention. Now, Paul, you were talking earlier about the different languages around the world. I had the idea that people just started these guttural sounds to indicate what they wanted, you know, grunts. And finally, they came up with a language. And over here on this part of the world, they developed their own language. Over there on that part of the world, they developed their own language. And so on. I am probably wrong about this, but this is the only thing that kind of logically made sense to me. And then we have the story of the Tower of Babel, which Excuse me if you do believe it, but I don't. What is your take on the Tower of Babel versus different languages, the origin of different languages around the world?
Well, I treat a chapter in the book on that particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
My theory is sort of a combination of the 2 points that you just made.
Okay.
One of them is, I think that we don't know about the language of Homo erectus and so forth, but we know they were civil group-oriented people beings. So there was likely some degree of communication among them along the primitive side that you just mentioned.
Right.
But to have the facility for our expressions with our voice box, this only became possible about 200,000 years ago when we had a gene, I think, inserted in our genome, or according to the mainstream scientists, it, you know, developed as a matter of natural selection, which doesn't make sense in this particular case. But this, it's called the FOXFP2 gene, discovered by the Max Planck Institute in Germany about 10 years or so ago, that made it possible for Homo sapiens about 200,000 years ago, and remember that date we were talking about this period,
right,
is the arising of Homo sapiens, and that made it possible to have a very much more complex and varied language. Now, thinking about this beginning of this period of Homo sapiens, and I associated, as Sitchin did, and as Michael Tellinger and other people are researching in these areas even now, that this first colonization and the genetic experimentation was done in southern Africa, where we have all of the artifacts and ruins of human habitations in that part of the continent down on the southeast coast of South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, and this is my theory, is that also we have in that same part of the world the guttural languages of the Pygmy tribes, and they started, you know, they have this famous language that we now all know about from music that we've had created from that, of the clicks, you know, so that it's a very different tonal, very different way of making the sounds for the language. I'm suggesting that that was the original aboriginal language outside of the colonial minds of the Homo sapiens who were being taught to be miners and to work for the extraterrestrials, the ABs, who were making them into slaves.
Mm.
And so the first African languages came from both the primitive humans who were outside of that colonization effort, and the beginning of the languages of people within that colony. And that's the proto-world language that linguists have hypothesized.
Hmm.
Now, that, as the different ABs made their own little tribes and city-states, as happened in the Middle East and the Sumerian cradle of Western civilization in the Indus Valley in what's now Pakistan and India, the Tian Shan Plateau in China. So you had different languages out of this proto-language develop, and my hypothesis is then back to the Tower of Babel story.
Okay.
The Tower of Babel story was that humans were learning the languages or the language of the gods, and they were beginning to aspire to ascend into the heavens just like the gods did. And because the gods at that time, the Abs, were wanting to keep the humans down, so the answer was, you won't know our language. You will then be broken into different language groups by the different sort of sub-rulers of this AB group. And we have that, you know. You have the gods of the god of Babylon. You have the god of the Hebrews. You have the god of the Hindus. You know, all of the different centers of civilization after the cataclysm of 11,500 years ago, which was after the, what we call the flood in the Bible, but what around the world was known as a different kind of phenomenon. Some of them talk about the stories relate, you know, things like volcanoes and earthquakes and
Polar shift, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was a polar shift. I think it was a more traumatic cataclysm than that. I think it was a passing body that had a lot of not only geophysical effects but also electromagnetic effects. Because there's a interesting book that's been out now of 10 or more years called The Cataclysm of 11,500 Years Ago. Well, they say 9,500 BP. And this was a collection of evidence around the world suggesting that the Earth was subjected to this very powerful and disturbing cataclysm as some object passed by. Now, Sitchin has his own story, and other people have different stories about that, but I think something did. The Greeks go back, and, you know, they have another name for it.
Well, so, it seems that a passing body, like Planet X, as they like to call it, Nibiru, is that the...
Yeah, Nibiru is...
Wormwood, whatever.
From the Sumerian, yeah.
Yeah, right. It would seem that that would, or could, cause a polar shift, and there's much scientific evidence to suggest that there has been polar shift five or six times, if I recall.
Right. No, I'm not suggesting that a polar shift was not a part of this.
Okay.
Phenomenon, but I think it was more than that.
Okay.
Because it seems to me that prior to that period of 11,500 years ago, we were going through one particular ice age. You know, the Earth has gone through these cyclical ice ages for hundreds of thousands and millions of years.
Right.
But the one that was going on before about 12,000 years ago, rather abruptly ceased about that time, according to even mainstream science. So it seems to me that what happened is this cataclysm, first of all, aborted the ice age that was in play at that particular time. It could have affected a polar shift. It could have affected tectonic plates on the edges of continents. It probably also accounted for the upheavaling of the Andes and the Rockies and the Alps and the Himalayas about that same time, about 12,000 years ago.
Right.
And these are all documented geophysical facts. And the event itself being worldwide probably wiped out most of the humans. And I give you just one clue supporting that, and that is the story of Atlantis. It has been speculated based on different bits of evidence here and there. We don't have the full story. But that about the same time, that was the last gasp of Atlantis. And that's pointed to by Plato's reports of the Egyptians telling, you know, that account that they had kept for thousands of years in their own history.
Mm-hmm.
So I see those things coming together, where you had very few survivors left in terms of humans. And scientists speculate that about that time we might have only had, hundreds of thousands of humans on the whole planet.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when the gods came back. They'd pulled away before the cataclysm. They came back. The story of Noah and the flood, of course, is one example of that.
Mm-hmm.
But they came back and they helped the human survivors. And that's the source of the creation of Western civilization, of the Asian civilization, of the South Asian civilizations, the Hindu culture in what's now India, and what we know in modern times as the Incas, that is the Andes cultures.
Right. So, well, it would seem that all of the deity myths around the world have been have one thing in common. All of their gods came down from the sky.
All of them came from the sky. All of them had some fights among themselves.
Right.
All of them taught languages to humans and other things.
Mm-hmm.
I found it very interesting. I reviewed, dozens of these myths and legends from around the world, and they all talk about, you know, the gods taught us languages, the gods gave us this, and you know, we humans today, if we create or invent something, boy, we're proud about it and try to claim our fame, you know.
Right.
But in all these stories, these accounts of the early origins of civilizations, the humans weren't claiming that. They said it came from the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so universal in Egyptian, Indian, African, Asian. So why don't we believe the stories of our ancestors when they talk about the gods, when they talk about the contacts, when they talk about the cataclysm, when they talk about the languages?
Because it's not scientific enough. It doesn't fit with conventional wisdom.
That's right, with conventional wisdom.
Right.
And that's why in the second half of my book, I focus so much on how this experience has shaped human history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our religions came from that colonial experience with the ABs ruling and causing humans to obey, to worship, to make sacrifices to frightened by the power of the gods. You know, all of those things shaped the parameters of what we have as modern religions today. And I have a couple of chapters there that talk about this evolution from the times when they were simply the colonial rulers of the advanced beings and the lesser humans, lesser knowledge, lesser skill, lesser, you know, whatever.
Right.
And then, though, about, I would say, 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, the stories suggest that they pulled away and left humans alone, but they left behind a lot of the human cities and states and nations as they were at that time. They were relatively small groups of people. But they were then ruled by these hybrids, the progeny of the advanced beings with human females. And, you know, we have this story of the royal bloodline and all of that. I think there is a little bit of truth in that.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened, as long as the ABs were here with their machines that could take off into the skies and those kinds of technologies, humans were awed by them. They were afraid of them. They were cowed. They took orders very easily, and they served them. But when the gods took off, then the rulers who were left, the half-breed rulers who were left, and the priesthoods who were serving them, kept perpetuating the notion that these gods are coming back, and we've got to continue to worship them, we've got to be loyal, and you've got to do sacrifices, and so on. And so this is what I call, and I think historical accounts in many, many cultures bear this out, from about 3 to 4,000 years ago up to about 1,500 years ago, we had this period of cults. And the cults were essentially the followers of one god or the other who had been gone now for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. But they continued because the priest kept telling them, they're coming back and you got to behave like you used to. And then when Christianity came along, you know, with Jesus teaching a very different story about humans and their relationship to the Creator and all of that, just like Buddha 500 years before Jesus. They were, people like this were trying to get humans to become self-responsible, independent, to get out from under this priesthood and the notion of a warring, vengeful God.
Right.
But unfortunately, his teachings didn't catch on because Constantine and the leaders of the Roman version of Christianity created this concoction between the Old Testament, the stories of the gods and their punishment and all of that, the threats and the vengeful kind of beings that they were.
Right.
That was conflated with sort of the teachings that Jesus was passing on about we're all part of the Creator, we're all equal, we are responsible for ourselves, we should live and relate to each other in certain constructive ways and so on.
So
that all got lost because of the history that we've had.
Right. So the merciless God now becomes the merciful God. Right.
Well, it would have been all right if we had made the shift, you know. But what happened is that they tried to make it both, you know, that God is very demanding and punishes you if you do not behave like the priests say you should behave, and you're going to go to hell if you don't follow the rituals and the beliefs of a particular religion.
Right, right. Well, so, that's what I find is so confusing, ironic, is that, you know, there are 3,000 different Orthodox religions in the world, 1,200 of them based on Christianity, and they all have one thing in common. They all think their way is the right way, and the rest of them are going to hell.
Yeah.
So we need to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone.
Foreclosure is hard on every member of the family, but your family is not alone. If you're struggling with your mortgage, there is help. To learn about the government's Making Home Affordable program, visit makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE to speak to a HUD-approved housing counselor. It's free of charge. Visit makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE today. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, NeighborWorks America, and the Ad Council.
I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Paul Von Ward. And let's continue with this. Now, you were, you say you were a Baptist minister.
Yes, in my young days, I was very active in the church in my teens and and I became a youth minister of a large church in Florida, and I became a sort of youth evangelist for a couple of years, and I was ordained by Presbytery of Ministers in Tallahassee, Florida, and pastored a church for a while. But as I went through this intellectual metamorphosis that we described a little earlier, I obviously couldn't be consistent in my own beliefs in the research and the study of history and culture.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask how you were able to acclimate your religious beliefs with the ET hypothesis.
Well, they're incompatible, so that's why I'm no longer practicing Christian. Or,
you know, now I'm not going to remember his name, the author of the UFOs and the Bible and UFOs, the Bible and Flying Saucers, that's it.
Right.
Barry Downing, Reverend Barry Downing.
Yeah.
He's a minister. He's a Christian, but he believes that a lot of these biblical myths were ETs coming in spacecraft, forerunners of today's UFO phenomenon.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I think it's possible to say, okay, there is a spiritual creator. However, some of these ABs, as you call them, advanced beings, or we know them more as ETs or extraterrestrials, these beings that came down from wherever, other planets, other dimensions, wherever they're from, the greater reality that we aren't really quite aware of as of yet, still trying to understand. You can acclimate, you can say, okay, you know, there is a spiritual creator, but these are physical beings. These are physical beings, and way back when mankind revered them as gods or angels of gods or God himself. So is it possible to have both the spiritual beliefs, you know, that is spiritual, and believe in a extraterrestrial or other dimensional beings that are physical?
Well, sure, it's possible to merge those two worldviews. In fact, as you know, the Vatican has made statements, public press releases to the effect that, you know, extraterrestrials are just brothers in Christ and fit into our cosmology.
Right.
I have a different take on that. I do think it's possible to think about these advanced beings in terms of a spiritual aspect to the universe. But you see, one of the problems that I have with supernatural religions is there is a supposed division between the divine realm and the realm that we are parts of.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a book on cosmology that I published about 10 or 12 years ago on the self-learning universe. I believe the universe is the product of a conscious creation or source of whatever, you know, was before we were in this universe. So that I have no problem with, and I think that there, all these other dimensions that we are now getting closer to understanding through our experiments in physics and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But that, to me, then suggest that the universe is an integral organism, and there's not a supernatural aspect to it that, you know, manipulates the material aspect of the universe, but that we're actually just on a spectrum from the most dense concrete material level right up to the highest and most refined frequencies of energy and consciousness.
Right.
And so I look at it as one whole package that way, and that excludes the idea that, you know, we've had this Savior come to the earth, and there's a special sanction for the believers in that particular Savior or some other particular being. And so I don't argue with people who want to try to integrate the ET phenomena into a more or less expanded kind of Christianity. But I just think that what we've done is we've built such a psychological set about, you know, worship, the notion of humans not having the responsibility that it's God who's going to solve the problem for us, and so on. I think we are all beings responsible for our own species' health and well-being, and making decisions to do the best we can to keep our planet and our natural systems working.
So you're a believer in God helps them who helps himself, right?
Well, that's one way of saying it.
One way of saying it.
Well, my sense, I was on a show just a few days ago, and we had a little discussion like this, and and I said, you know, we're in a situation where all of us, whatever species, whether it's an advanced species, lesser advanced species, the humans and all of the other beings that we've given different names to, we're all aspects of the same creative force.
Right.
And we are all responsible for our place in the order of life. And we are responsible for taking care of whatever part of the universe that we're in that we have some control over. And that we're responsible for it in the future. And we are here to learn and to experiment and to develop ourselves. And who knows, and one of my other projects over the last 6 years has been on reincarnation and how that's an evolving process of consciousness of all species.
So you do believe there is a human spirit that survives physical death?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't call it a spirit. I call it
energy,
you know, the consciousness.
Right.
I use the term soul, genome, or psychoplasm. In other words, it is integral to life. You cannot have a live being without this, and I'm talking about all species now. You can't have a live being that does not have the informational charge, if you please, that activates the biological processes that are the essence of life, of biological life.
So it's an energy. It's an energy with a which is contains the seed of consciousness.
That's right.
Okay.
I would even say the seed of consciousness because that sort of sounds separate. I would say it is consciousness itself. Concentrated in an energy field that has the power to activate the viruses at that level and humans at our level. And when the physical manifestation is aborted in some way, I mean, it could be by death, it could be by just wearing out, then...
That causes death. Wearing out causes death.
That's right. Well, a lot of people do, you know, do live till they wear out.
Yeah.
And then you can have accidents and wars and disease and so on.
All right.
But whatever the cause is, there is then the residual energetic conscious feel. That then is active in another dimensional feel that we occupy in that stage for some time, and then we re-manifest like particles, you know, flashing in and out of existence at the subatomic level.
Right.
But this happens on our individual level.
Right. I was going to ask you also about, we were talking about languages and what have you. There were allegedly symbols on the craft that crashed at Roswell in 1947 that resembled Egyptian hieroglyphics. And some UFO witnesses claim to have seen like symbols on other craft. Do you think there is a connection between these symbols and actual Egyptian hieroglyphics?
Well, I think there's a possibility there. I've looked at some illustrations of, you know, those hieroglyphics or
symbols.
Hieroglyphics, we call them just images that are close to hieroglyphics.
Right.
We know that, you know, language, the written language evolves, you know, year by year, user by user. So it's very possible, and I suspect somewhat likely, that those may have been the predecessors of the hieroglyphics, because in the Egyptian tradition, they say that Thoth, one of these advanced beings, actually gave them those their language and their alphabet,
right?
Just like the Hindus do. They attribute it to Sarasvati, a goddess who gave them the Hindu Sanskrit words and signs that we have now.
Yeah. Well, when you stop and think of it, our letters in our alphabet are nothing more than symbols.
Exactly.
You know? So what difference would it make if you A, B, C, or some hieroglyphic symbol, you know?
Sure.
If you learn that this particular symbol meant a letter or a word, what difference does it make?
Yeah. No, I think this is... When we under, and if you go back and look at early languages, there are the claims, you know, that those alphabets had to do with the energetic expressions of these, you want to call them letters or syllables or pictographs or whatever.
Right.
But they were created to be energetically based in our communications and our thoughts, that they had energy with them that were consistent with the object or the action that they were supposed to be linked with.
Right.
And, of course, we've lost all of that now in our modern languages for the most part. And we've become so technocratic, you know, in creation of new words and so on.
Right. Well, if it's not Egyptian hieroglyphics, it's a... is the symbols of Japanese, Chinese, and like I say, our own alphabet.
Sure.
So
the difference in the Chinese that was a different system, because it was not just a word or a symbol of a syllable; it was a whole concept.
Oh.
And so, like a sentence, and that's what makes them so difficult for Westerners to use. But that's also, I mean, it's just another way of thinking about communication, you know. We think about it a-ba-sa, you know, whereas the Chinese give you one sound, and the way it's expressed, it could mean a completely different sentence or thought.
So,
and these are, all of these languages and alphabets and so on are artificial constructs of a culture trying to express its inner awareness and its appreciation of the external world that, you know, that we're living in.
Right. Mr. Paul Von Ward, where can we go to find out more about your work?
Well, my website is www.vonward.com. And there's information about all kinds of articles and comments of one kind or the other, information about the books and so on.
Right.
Well, I call myself an interdisciplinary cosmologist, looking with science and other fields melded together to give us the bigger picture of what we're a part of.
Very good. Well, I certainly appreciate you joining us tonight, Paul.
It's been a pleasure, Dave, and thanks so much. I enjoyed
it. Thank you. And if you, if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, UFOImplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
This is Alex from the Left of the Dial radio program. Here's wishing you and yours a safe and happy holiday season.
Now my money's gone. Woo, and it's so long, Johnny, bye-bye.
Let's declare an International Blues Music Day. Hi, my name is Johnny Childs, blues musician and president of the New York City Blues Society. To support this great cause, please join our Facebook group called Petition to Declare an International Blues Music Day. Join the discussion and let's create a formal day to celebrate blues music. From its legends and pioneers in the U.S. to the continually evolving pool of modern-day blues artists around the world. Let's celebrate our love for this great American art form and bring more recognition and support to blues music for many generations to come. Find our Facebook group called Petition to Declare an International Blues Music Day. This is Johnny Childs saying thank you for supporting the blues.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Web Advisor is a secure internet program that allows HFCC students and faculty to safely access their college-related information. Through Web Advisor, current students may register for classes, drop-in classes, pay for classes.